Chapter 3.
Beginning at verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, of the devil. For where you have evil and selfish ambition, there you will find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness. If I were to ask you to picture a wise man, I cannot imagine what portraits you might take from the wall of your mind. I suspect that there might be some of you influenced by several decades of Christmas who think of wise men as those three fellows from the East riding camels by starlight who brought those questionable gifts to the young child Jesus. Think of wise men that way, you think of people of the long ago and far away. People lived at a different time and a different place than we do. But perhaps if you thought of a wise man, you might think of someone in a seminary or in a university. You might think of a scholar shut into his books, shut out from the world, somebody with ink in his veins, a kind of person who, if he had to make it in the marketplace, in the busy round of life, in the office or the shop or the factory, would be horribly inept. You might think of a wise man as somebody who is theoretical but impractical. Or perhaps if you thought about a wise man, you wouldn't think about a wise man at all. In the 20th century, what you might think of is an informed man. We live in a day in which we have a high regard for information. And so the kind of person that might come to your mind is an expert, somebody who controlled a certain body of facts. But certainly in the 20th century, we tend to think that knowledge is moral, and we give it a very high grade. For example, suppose you had the responsibility of choosing someone to be a faculty member at a high school, or at a college, or at a seminary. What are the kinds of things you would look at? Well, I know that one of the things we would look at would be whether or not the person had gone to a college or a university, whether they had been graduated. If we really wanted to do a study, we would ask for a transcript of their records to see what kinds of grades they made. And I suppose, in particular areas, we would like an advanced degree. That is, if they're going to teach a tiny sliver of knowledge, we'd like to be sure that they had control of that. As a result, the most of what we would look at would have to do with information. Were they exposed to the right courses? And did they get the right letters on their grade point? Now, certainly nothing wrong with knowledge. But the tendency for us to say that knowledge is power is to quote that maxim as though it were carved in stone on Mount Sinai. Certainly knowledge is power. And that's one of its difficulties. Because we have knowledge and we have power, and we're frightened to death of what we have. It's not enough simply to have knowledge or a knowledge that people have knowledge. What you're really trying to find out is something about the knower. That is, how is the knowledge used? And that has to do with wisdom. Because knowledge can be constructive, but knowledge can be destructive. You can teach a boy to write, and he may, as a result of that, turn out to be a Robert Louis Stevenson. On the other hand, you may teach him to write, and he can end up being a forger. Back in the Old Testament, Solomon constructed a temple in Jerusalem to God. It was magnificently beautiful. In order to do it, he had to draw upon the extensive knowledge of architecture that they had 1,000 years before Christ. That was knowledge used in God's service. In Genesis 11, we read it of the Tower of Babel, that the tower also drew on the extensive knowledge of architecture, but it was raised as a monument of opposition to God. You can want the knowledge because that can remove the mystery of life. Or you can look for knowledge in order to make gadgets that will keep you from looking at life's ultimate issues. Knowledge can be used to benefit people, but it can also be used to hurt people. So the question, what is a wise man, is not simply to ask, does the person have knowledge? It's to ask something about the person himself, how he uses knowledge. Here in James chapter 3, James is talking about people who want to be teachers. He begins the chapter by urging folks not to line up quickly to take that position, because they're going to receive the greater judgment. If you propose to tell other people how to live, then you can be sure that God will apply the standards you apply to others to yourself. And so one qualification that we ought to look for in ourselves and in others who are teachers, he says in the first two verses, is that they ought to be mature. That is, they ought to have control of their personality. And the way you find out whether or not an individual is mature, James says, is by looking at their tongue. Whether you can control your speech indicates whether you have control over your total personality. A person who does not control speech indicates an immaturity, an inability to control other elements of his life. But the second thing a teacher needs is wisdom. And in verse 13, James introduces that by asking the question, who is wise and understanding among you? Those two words, wisdom and understanding, used together, are used in the Old Testament to speak of an insight that God gives. You find that in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 15 and 16, Deuteronomy 4, 6, and Daniel 5:12. It was a way of summarizing in two words, insight. Wisdom, as we have said several times before in the Old Testament, referred to a skill. The Hebrew word is chokmah, and it was used for a skill for building, or a skill for weaving, or a skill for sailing, or a skill for administering. And then it came to mean a skill for living, an ability to handle life well. The word understanding was used for somebody who was an expert, somebody who had a particular skill in a particular area. And so the two together mean an ability to have insight into life and to handle life well. What you want in a teacher is wisdom and understanding. Now the question is, how do you discover it? Whether a person has that kind of wisdom and understanding. If the test of your maturity is in the way you speak, then what is the test of wisdom? And James responds by saying, let him show that he has wisdom by his good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. William Barclay translates that, let him show by the loveliness of his behavior that all that he does is done with gentleness. You really can't imagine, living in the 20th century, how strange that would have sounded to the people in the Greco-Roman world. They were people who admired wisdom. In fact, one of the great movements in the 1st century was the movement of the Sophists. We use the word sophist, if we ever use it at all, negatively. We talk about sophistry as a trickery. But the sophists were highly regarded. They would be like the scholars in our day. And one of the things that people admired in the first century was the ability to be an orator. In fact, as far back as Plato and Isocrates, through men like Aristotle to Quintilian to Cicero, a great deal of what those men wrote about had to do with the ability to be a rhetorician, to be able to make your arguments, to move an audience, to refute an opponent. These men were in that century what professional athletes would be today. They went from city to city. They made their speeches, and the people had a tremendous ability to judge an orator, like a sports fan who watches pro football, can judge a tight end. In a city like Corinth, they actually had statues to the orators, to the rhetoricians. The ability to speak, the ability to speak persuasively, the ability to move an audience, the ability to refute, that was held in high regard. They would have said the test of whether you have wisdom or understanding is how well you can make a case and how well you can refute those who disagree with you. What is more, if they even bought what James was saying, that is, he ought to show it by his life, they would not quite respond that what you ought to look for are deeds done in humility, or the loveliness of behavior that shows that all that you do is done in gentleness. Again, because we live off the fragrance of the Christian faith, we have a high regard for humility and modesty, gentleness. But that was not true in the Greek world. In fact, the Greeks looked at modesty and humility and gentleness as vices. They were the fruit of weakness. They expected their leaders, their orators, their champions to stand up and to dominate. It was a mark of strength. So in two counts, James's response let him show by the loveliness of his behavior that all that he does is done in gentleness, would have cut across the thinking of the people in the first century. Yet James is saying that the test of whether or not you are wise is not primarily in the way you speak, but in the way you act. And it's shown by gentleness. Seems to me that there are at least two vices that those of us who are teachers easily fall into. One of the vices is arrogance. It is easy when you are speaking and presenting a case to people to feel that if someone disagrees with you, they are disagreeing with God. That they are attacking you and attacking your ego. Too many times, teachers fall into the description that Shakespeare has of one of his characters, where, as the character say, "I am Sir Oracle. When I speak, let all dogs be silent." It's a danger of being a teacher, that you develop arrogance. The second danger is that you can develop anger. Anger, especially with those who disagree with you. Seems to me that's the test of really what you are. Not how you respond to those who applaud for you, but how you respond for those who disagree with you, who take another position, who feel that you're wrong and who state it. Very easy to become angry with that person, whether it's somebody in the congregation or whether it's your wife or your teenager. There is a danger of arrogance and anger. And you can imagine what that would have done and what it does today in a church. A man who proposes to teach the people of God can, if he develops a sense of arrogance, authoritarianism, if he develops hostility towards those in the group who do not quite see things as he does, kind of attitude can tear and does tear churches apart. It's the kind of thing that divides people rather than draws them together. So the test of a teacher is whether or not, through the loveliness of his behavior, he demonstrates that what he does with gentleness. To do that is to show that you're qualified to teach the people of God. So what James is saying in this passage is that wisdom is not so much a matter of knowledge. He's certainly not putting that down. It's a matter of motive. It's not so much what the person knows, but what the person does with what he knows. That it's a matter of motive, whether you're wise. And out of that motive, there come the good fruits of righteousness. In order to make that point, that knowledge, that wisdom is a matter of motive, and that out of that, that good things happen, he defends that, or proves it, first of all, negatively. He takes what he believes is the knowledge that God gives and contrasts it with the counterfeit variety that passes in our society. And so negatively, he says, but if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, of the devil. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. The word that he uses for envy is the Greek word. In fact, the word is zealots in the Greek, like our word zeal. And zeal is a good thing. You want people who teach to be enthusiastic about what they teach, to be sold on it. Zeal can be a good thing. But if zeal is taken too far, then it becomes fanaticism. And fanaticism is often a destructive thing. It is a good fruit gone sour. If a teacher has a zeal that becomes fanatic, then he will not tolerate opposition. He becomes dominant. And if you have bitter and selfish ambition in your hearts, that is, that's the desire to win. That is, if your purpose in discussing something, your purpose in teaching something, is to lord it over an opponent, to demonstrate that you're right and the other person is wrong, that motive is, he says, to lie against the truth. That's true on an individual basis. If when you get into a discussion, an argument with your wife, if you come to the place in that discussion that you want to win, that's the motive, you'll find it does all kinds of harm. Sometimes men can be very articulate. And they can sort of wrap their wives around a verbal pole. She doesn't quite know how to answer it all, and so they win. And they lose. Because the zeal that says, I've got to be right and no one opposes me, the determination that you will win, he says, is a lie against the truth. What he means by that is that truth is not given as a sword in order to tear people apart. It's not given as a hammer to knock people down. It is given as something to which we are to submit ourselves and thus to produce in us a beauty of life. It's very possible for a teacher to use truth and actually to be right. And in the course of that argument and that debate, to wound an opponent. It's very hard, isn't it, to hold something with deep conviction and argue for that position without at the same time trying to tear down those who disagree with you. And without wounding people who oppose you. Very hard. If you don't care about it, it doesn't matter to you. You're discussing whether or not it's going to rain tomorrow. That's easy. But when you really hold to something dearly, you hold it objectively, difficult. It's possible to take the truth and use it as a weapon to hurt people, to tear them down, so that in your zeal and in your ambition, you will win. I think Paul in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15, also talking about the same general subject, says that we are to hold the truth in love. That dynamic is essential. It's not enough just to hold truth, to hold it in love. I have a friend who is well known as a brilliant Christian apologist. He is a defender of the faith. And to his high credit, he often gets out into the arena, into the marketplace, and takes on opponents, and often does so at the university. He and I have talked about it. And I don't think I'm making a judgment, but one of the difficulties is when you get into a debate, and he is a marvelous debater, you focus on wanting to win the debate. And on several occasions, once when he debated Altheiser, who was the man who was several years ago noted for the God is Dead movement. Altheiser was a poet. No match for my friend. Really wasn't. And he had a debate with him at the University of Chicago. And by all accounts, wiped him out. We were commenting on that. And he said to me, yeah, he said, I won the debate, but I lost the audience. He said, in the course of things, I think I made him look like a fool. And he said, I won, but I lost. Because the congregation, the audience, recognized that what I did was foreign to the spirit of Jesus Christ. That's the kind of thing James is talking about. And I say that about my friend, not to be critical, because I understand that temptation. And that's to lie against the truth. That is to use the truth as it was not intended. It is to use it to serve your own ego needs. And to do that is, he says, to use a wisdom that's very much characteristic of our society. I taught at the University of Illinois. You discover in academia that the vice of the academician is pride. And you cross swords and you discover that if you're a graduate student and you cross swords with your advisor, you may never get your PhD degree. And again, I knew of fellows in those programs who didn't get it because they disagreed strongly with an advisor. Same sort of thing. It wasn't a matter of looking for truth, it was a matter of using truth to make you look good. And he says that kind of wisdom doesn't come down from heaven. God doesn't give that kind of wisdom, as impressive as it may be in our society. But it's earthly. That is, it's of this world, it's of our culture. It smells of dirt. It's unspiritual, and the word that is used there is the word that the Bible uses in that those relationships in which we're closest to the animals. Beastly. The kind of wisdom that can snarl and snap, bite. In fact, it's of the devil because it's opposed to truth. The person really doesn't want to know the person wants to win. And he says, that kind of wisdom, which comes from that sort of motive, envy and selfish ambition, produces disorder and every evil practice. I was reflecting on that last week. Seems to me that that's very true of our society. When you look at our national pursuit of knowledge, back in the early 1960s, President Kennedy determined that by the end of that decade, we would put a man on the moon. The reason for doing that was not pure science. The reason for doing it was a few years before the Russians had put the Sputnik up into space and made us look bad. And now we were going to get one up on the Russians. There was zeal. There was ambition. And we did it. 1969, we landed on the moon. And we learned a great deal. And I have no quarrel with the space program. Except that we know now that when we put those satellites up into space, one large part of what we are doing is for the military. That we have taken the quarrels that now are limited to Lebanon, Grenada. We're looking to shoot them up into the heavens. And as we look forward to the next decade or so, we're going to be fighting up in space. So as good as that knowledge may seem, and the knowledge itself is neutral, when it's produced out of the selfishness and the ambition, it terrifies us. You come to recognize what that can mean. Or take the whole study of nuclear energy. That came, as you well know, back in World War II. We were competing because we were afraid that the Japanese or the Germans would get the ability to break the atom before we did. And we won. We got the bomb. We dropped it. We won. Only trouble is we have created a monster. That knowledge that has come out of that zeal, that ambition, now threatens to destroy the race. On a lesser level, in a church, I don't know that I have ever been involved in a church split, church squabble that didn't talk truth. You know, everybody's got a theological issue. Nobody wants to talk about how true they are to God. What they do is they use truth to bludgeon one another. And they're arguing truth, but they're living a lie. That proves to this is disorder in every evil practice. That's true when couples argue. Say, look, I am ambitious and I'm zealous and got corrupt motives. Let me talk about that. You know, I've got my rights. I've got facts. He may be right. Maybe right. But if it comes out of that kind of motivation, it produces all kinds of evil and disharmony. And that's why a teacher must be wise. There must be out of the loveliness of his behavior, the demonstration that what he does with gentleness. That's the wisdom of our world. It's the wisdom that you get if you watch television too much. The wisdom that you get if you go to the local bookstore to get their insights into life. Winning by intimidation. that's an interesting whole set of things, isn't it? And you'll win. You will. You'll win in our society by intimidating. Or out on marriage. You know, one of the live options is to break the thing up. That kind of knowledge, used with that kind of motive, can be destructive. Is destructive. Comes from hell. But he says, the wisdom that comes from God, remember the point he is making is that wisdom really has to do with motive. And good motive in the use of knowledge produces good results. He says the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure. The thing to underline is first of all. That is, it is basically pure. It really wants to know. It really wants to understand. It really wants to hear the other person out. It is really interested in being submissive to truth if it can find it. Not interested in winning. It's interested in helping. It's first of all pure. Then, because it is pure, it is open to other people when they disagree. And he says, it's peace-loving, it's considerate, it's submissive. That is, if I really want to know the truth, if I am really eager to be in submissive to what the truth is, and that's my motive, then if somebody disagrees with me, I can hear them out. Our tendency is when we want to win, when you're making your point, I listen to you, but inside I'm picking up 10 arguments to knock you down. I'm not really listening at all. I am marshaling what I have to say in order to refute. And so what I want to do is to win. But if it's really pure, then it's peace-loving. It wants to bring people to God. It wants to bring people to each other. It is interested in building bridges, not walls. It is considerate. That is, it wants to make other people feel comfortable. It's a difficult word to translate. It's a word that Aristotle used for tempering justice with mercy. It's a word that was used of God in the Septuagint, in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, when God as a king is what considerate. That is, he does not deal with us after our sin or reward us according to our iniquity. Everything is not up to tough, hard standards. If it's pure, it makes allowance for other people. It understands where they're coming from. It's got a gentleness to it. And then it's submissive. The opposite of the word submissive is easier. It's not obstinate. It's open to reason, as some of the translations have it. If I really want to know the truth, and if you say to me, I don't think you really understand it, then it's open to reason. It has an openness to those who disagree, to hear them out, to be sure you understand. And then, not only does it have purity about it, and is open to those who would disagree, but it's designed to help others. It's full of mercy and good fruit. The teacher in teaching truth ought to have as a motive wanting other people to be benefited by it. Jonathan Edwards, the great New England preacher who said, I have made it the aim of my life, God helping me, never to prepare a sermon or to preach it unless I am motivated by love for those to whom I preach. So what you're not looking for is applause. You're looking for benefit for those who listen. It's full of good fruit. Because when you're under teaching in which the teacher in good motive is trying to present God's truth, it's like a luscious fruit to someone that is hungry. It feeds you, it nourishes you, it refreshes you. And then finally, it comes from good motive. It's impartial. It's sincere. By impartial, it means it presents the truth not to get at somebody else. It is a great temptation for somebody who cannot and will not deal with a person in the congregation eye to eye, heart to heart, to bring it into the pulpit and preach to the whole congregation or refute some folks up front. We've all done that, I suppose. We've been tempted to do it. Real wisdom doesn't do that. It doesn't have a hidden agenda when it's presenting truth. The agenda to refute, to win. That is, it's sincere. That is, it's without hypocrisy. The word that is used is a word that was used in the first century of actors who wore a mask. They did not have actresses back then, so parts of women were done by men who wore a mask of a woman. It's to conceal. The wisdom is open. It is vulnerable. It's transparent. Think about this, and I remember a time some years ago when I was with the Christian Medical Society. We had a symposium, and one of those who came was a physician from Great Britain. And in the course of one of the discussions, we were discussing the question of eternal punishment and hell. I cannot remember how that fit into the symposium, but he did not believe in eternal punishment, hell. When he stood up, he said, let me tell you what I would like to believe. I would like to believe that the Bible does not teach eternal punishment. I find it difficult emotionally to accept. And I say that to you because I look at certain passages that seem to me to teach that, but that is not a biblical doctrine. But I'm aware that I come to this out of my own emotion. And you need to know that. And then he proceeded to give us his case. I admired him for that. I thought there's a man who, right or wrong, agree or disagree, was laying out on the table his hidden agenda and not making it hidden. He was not a zealot. He believed what he taught, but he knew that he had come to what he believed, in part at least, from his own emotional needs. And I learned from that. I have a friend in Dallas, a former professor at the seminary there, and Ed has that ability. He holds strong convictions. But you can discuss anything with him. And he is a man who is concerned to know the truth of God, and that gives him a gentleness. There's never a manipulativeness about him. He is sincere, and he has had a ministry that has been blessed of God for that reason. And so the summation is that the peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness. The right motive in teaching produces peace and not antagonism. And out of the atmosphere of peace, and that is your concern, to bring people together, to bring people to God, there comes out of that teaching, instead of disunity and evil, righteousness and good. This is written primarily to those who would be teachers. But obviously, if it is something to be valued, then it's something for which all of us ought to strive. James chapter 1, James says, if any of us lack wisdom in the midst of trials, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally. In light of this passage, you ask God for wisdom. You're not necessarily asking God for answers. You're asking him for attitude. An attitude that is submissive and gentle. To be wise is not to be a genius. It is to be gentle. To be wise is not to have solutions, but to have an attitude of submission to God and submission to others. A teachable spirit by which we can teach others. And God will give you that. if you ask for it in faith. If you really want it, it is one of the works you'll perform or begin to perform in your life. Knowledge is important, but wisdom has to do with how we use knowledge. It deals not with information, but with motive. All right, do you have any questions or comments or interaction? Well, let's have a word of prayer. Father, in my better moments, when I see things as they really are, this is the kind of person I desperately want to be. To show by the loveliness of my behavior that all that I do is done in gentleness, in teaching, to benefit those I teach, in refuting, to be able to deal with arguments and yet not hurt those who disagree. You and I both know how difficult that is for me to do. But the challenge of this comes back to me, and I want to be submissive to you and to your truth. Lord, I pray for these men, that this may be true for them in discussions that they have with colleagues, with the teenagers, with their wives, and the responsibilities they have in local congregations. Grant that by the loveliness of our behavior, we may demonstrate that all we do is done with gentleness. Make us wise and understanding. In Jesus' name, amen.